So, Laura, I'll turn the floor over to you to actually begin the session. So, if you'd like to call up your presentation materials, I'm going to swap the view so that the audience can see your video instead of mine. And we'll give you a quick confirmation once those slides are up. And there we go. We can see your slides. So, I'll turn the floor to you.
Thank you, Jean. My name is Laura Strine. I'm with EPA's Repowering America's Land Initiative. I've worked at EPA for more than 25 years, and I'm excited to be here today to talk to you about successful state programs for renewable energy on contaminated sites. I'm especially excited to be here with Paul Curran from Clean Capital and Kyle Miller from AC Power. They are two renewable energy developers who focus on contaminated sites. So today I'm going to provide an overview of Repowering America's Land Initiative. Then we're going to discuss a little bit about repowering state programs and what that means. And then I'm going to turn it over to Paul and Kyle, where they're going to talk about some of the projects that they've developed that have benefited from state programs. And then after that, we'll have a Q&A session. So we're really excited to engage with you today. We want to ask you a quick question, a Q&A response from the participants. We want to get to know a little bit about you today. This is a two-part reply. If you could please type in the chat the name or names of your locality, state, nation, tribe, country that you are either representing or that you would like to let us know that you're calling in from today. And also, if you could put in, are you a beginner, an intermediate, or an advanced renewable energy on contaminated sites viewer? So,
All right. So, Laura, I'm seeing responses coming into
oh,
that
great.
Q&A space. So,
Excellent.
we do have individuals indicating that they are from Pennsylvania, Iowa, Pennsylvania Department, DEP, Indiana with the Indiana Brownfields Program. We have New Jersey participants who are noting they are new to this, California, and they are beginners on renewable energy. Washington State, again, beginners. More Pennsylvanias, all noting that they are beginners. Well, we do have some intermediate levels joining us from Connecticut. We have people also coming in from South Florida that are beginners. New York State and the DEC up there, they are beginners. Ohio, beginners. We also have some from Shelter Island in New York in the Green Options Committee, and they're a volunteer, relatively new here. So again, a lot of state regulators, and I would say
Great.
the majority of the indications I'm seeing is that they're all new or beginners to this area.
Great. Well, welcome. This is a great place to start. We're so excited that you're here today. I have a quick disclaimer, three things. One, it's really important to note that repowering projects have to comply with local, state, and federal permitting and environmental rules. They need to consider proper planning, engineering, construction, and operation. So the development does not interfere with cleanup and does not increase threats to human health or the environment. The second is that EPA does not provide tax advice. And the third is that EPA does not endorse private companies. So those are my disclaimers. We will now move on to the content. Thank you. And you can see here we have some potential advantages of reusing contaminated land for renewable energy. Repowering America's Land Initiative is an initiative based in OLEM, the Office of Land and Emergency Management at EPA. Part of our mission is to encourage redevelopment of Superfund brownfields, RCRA sites, landfills, and state cleanup program sites. OLEM has other programs that focus on broader redevelopment options, but Repowering America's Land Initiative is specifically focused on renewable energy redevelopment. So you can see that there are a lot of advantages to redeveloping sites with renewable energy. And some of the advantages that we hear about most are increasing local revenue for local governments and preserving green space. So I want to talk about the intersection of renewable energy and potentially contaminated sites and clarify a term that we're going to be using today. The term is repowering, and repowering to us means siting renewable energy resources on land with either perceived or actual contamination. And so you'll hear me use that term throughout the presentation. So many states have programs to encourage renewable energy, and many states also have programs that handle contaminated sites, brownfields programs, et cetera. And so today, what we're really focused on is this intersection, this intersection of programs that states have created to address renewable energy and potentially contaminated site reuse. And we want to make sure that we recognize the leadership of states and cities on climate change. Repowering projects often rely on state policies and programs, and they do result in significant carbon emission reductions. More than 1.5 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent annually can be seen at the over 500 projects across the country, and they also do bring environmental justice benefits. So the federal landscape is that there are three programs. One is the IRA, one is the CPRG, the Climate Pollution Reduction Grants, and one is the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, just to name a few. These are the CPRG and the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund are EPA programs. So the federal landscape, has changed with these new programs, and funding for eligible renewable energy and other climate-related programs in states, territories, local governments, regional air quality districts, tribal governments, and nonprofit institutions are being made through these programs. So the goal of today's webinar is to provide you with examples of successful state programs for repowering projects and to learn how developers view state programs and how specific projects that they've developed have benefited from those programs. So we have categorized state programs that fall into this repowering category. There are many different types of programs. They include financial incentives and procurement preferences, site identification and development support. These can be maps or lists of sites, education and outreach. Streamlined permitting and environmental review is one that developers have often cited as being very helpful to redeveloping these sites with renewable energy. And liability relief programs can be very helpful as well. So there are different categories of common state programs that help with this redevelopment effort. So on this slide, you will see there are clearly states that have different types of incentives. We have, again, more broadly categorized these. We have states in blue with financial incentives only, states in green, or a state in green with streamlined permitting policies only. The three states in orange, Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey, have both financial incentives and streamlined permitting policies, and the white states have no repowering type policies. So they might have renewable energy policies and they might have contaminated land policies, but not the targeted policies that we're talking about today. And you can see that Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey have the majority of projects. The number in each state corresponds to the number of repowering projects in that state. And so there are 530 renewable energy projects with over 2.5 gigawatts of installed capacity. And for many of you, this might be a new concept, but for people like Kyle and Paul, these practices have been standard for many years. So this is not really a new practice. It might be a new idea to you, but it's been going on around the country for quite some time. And most of these projects are around 5 megawatts in size. And we are seeing more grid scale or utility scale projects being developed. So this graphic shows how much the three states with the highest number of repowering projects exceeded the national market share for solar capacity. And it's very likely that this performance is related to their state program. So you can see New York has two times the US national average of renewable energy, or sorry, solar on contaminated sites, and New Jersey and Massachusetts have seven times. So they really are leading the nation in this practice. So we have some examples of state programs. New Jersey has quite a robust program. This is just an image of their solar siting tool. The mapping tool that they have produced through the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection shows utility hosting capacity information as one of the data layers. And this information helps stakeholders better understand where to place new solar projects. And it helps developers and site owners select the best sites and project sizes for their development. The New York Build Ready program is through the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA. The state directly advances underutilized sites that would not otherwise be developed by the private sector. And they're looking at large-scale renewable energy development. And you can see they have this funnel approach, that is their site development process for projects in New York. And in Massachusetts, there's the SMART program administered by the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources. It's the main solar incentive program in Massachusetts, and it provides financial incentives to repowering projects, additional 4 cents a kilowatt hour for landfill projects, and an additional 3 cents per kilowatt hour for brownfields projects. And they studied the incentives needed for landfill and brownfield sites, and developed the program around that information. So we have some tips for implementing state programs. Consider a pilot, consider your stakeholders, and consider the timelines. This can be very important. There are certain programs that can be relatively quick to enable and implement, and there are some programs that might take a long time. So it's really important to consider the time that it takes. And one state that we highlight often is Illinois. They have a new recent brownfield solar program that requires at least 2% of their utility scale solar to come from brownfields. And that program is taking the projects are taking a little bit longer because they are large scale projects. And so there can be many different considerations for programs that states would like to implement. So I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. Our website is a great place for information. You can see here we have profiles of state programs, state program selection and design tips, and we have summaries that we created for at the request of the state of Michigan and the Commonwealth of Virginia. So these documents are very, some of them are very extensive. The profiles document is quite extensive. If you have any questions about that, please let me know. And I think I will sum this up by saying leading states have programs that are very intentional and that state programs are tailored to the needs in that particular state. And I will leave you with my contact information. And please sign up for our listserv. And we are happy to answer your questions either today or at any time. And I am now going to turn it over to Paul Curran from Clean Capital. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura. I'll see if I can do this right. And Jean, did I do it correctly?
Not at this time, Paul. We do not yet have your slides up. So if you could try clicking that screen share or share screen button one more time for me.
Sure.
And as you're doing that, I'll just let the audience know some of the hyperlinks that Laura was highlighting were just shared with you in the meeting chat. The meeting chat is disabled. You can receive messages we send, but you cannot send messages to us in the chat. So if you have a question, comment, or need to report a tech issue, you'll be using the Q&A for that. All right, Paul, we have confirmation. Your slides are up.
Thank you so much. So I have to say, I have been developing solar and wind projects for about 20 years on brownfields and landfills. And it's one of the most amazing things today, made my day, is that there's 260 some odd people here to listen and learn a little bit more about it. I have to start off with sort of the most obvious statement. This is a good idea. You know, we've worked on hundreds of these projects around the country. The one that you're looking at happens to be in Beacon, New York, about 20 miles away from where I'm sitting. It's been up and running for 6 or 7 years now. I just don't get calls from places where we have built these projects in the past and people saying, this is different than what you said. I've been involved in energy development for a long time, and that's not an unusual thing to get calls from people that are nervous about what will happen. But this is a good idea. There are no hidden aspects of putting, you know, a solar project on top of a landfill. It's taking space which really doesn't have a purpose. It's taking space which shouldn't be used for recreational purposes or public access, and it's putting it to a great use, which is the redevelopment of renewable energy. It's something that, as I say, you know, as you're considering policies, there are good ideas and there are bad ideas, but this, generally speaking, the idea of putting this on a landfill or a brownfield is a good idea. The designs that we use and that AC Power uses are safe and very well proven in many, many applications around the country. Just here's three projects that we're working on now. By the way, many of you may have talked to me under the name of BQ Energy. BQ Energy is still around. We're just, we were acquired by Clean Capital about a year and a half ago. And so we're doing the same thing, just better. In this case, here's three that I pulled out of the pile that are in construction right now. Two on the left are landfills. The 2 megawatts is about the normal size. That's about a 10 to 15 acre landfill. And generally speaking, you fill up the landfill with what you can. And I'll talk more about that later. The one on the right is a brownfield, used to be next to an ExxonMobil refinery down in downtown Buffalo. We were able to acquire the rights to some of that. Oftentimes, and that's an important point of this, is that that refinery used electricity. So building new power lines is not something that we have to do if we pick the right sites. And we work quite a bit on our screening of sites as we come into a new project. In this case, because the refinery used to use electricity and a lot of it, we could basically tap into the existing lines that were already there, even though the refinery shut down a long time ago. People don't go around taking down power lines, generally speaking. So these are just three projects that happen to be, you know, as I say, building right now. There are others. I'm going to do something that's I'm not an expert at, but just talk about policies. Generally speaking, we've seen a great diversity in the way people are approaching this. You know, there are different ways of doing it, and there is no bad one. We always kind of scratch our head when we get a call from a state that's thinking about this and saying, well, what would you like? And really, it depends on every state, and we haven't seen we've seen policies that don't work, and I'll talk about one or two later on. But there are different ways of doing this that can be tailored. Landfills are different than coal mines, are different than closed steel plants. utility scale is different than, you know, distributed generation, that kind of thing. So it is important to consider what you're trying to do with your individual state and to work from there. Kyle's going to talk a lot about New Jersey after me, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But this is a list of some policies that, you know, we pulled out. The one thing I will point out is 51% LMI customers. A lot of our sites are located in disadvantaged neighborhoods. You know, they are brownfields, they are landfills, and so forth. And so the link between the project and the community is often very poignant. And it's important that as we're trying to sell power through, you know, a community program, to be able to sell it as locally as we can. So state laws that encourage us to sell power to LMI customers are generally good ones, and we're used to them, and it makes a lot of sense. Rhode Island gives preference for brownfields is a simple statement. But generally speaking, a lot of states, Virginia and a couple of others, have looked at, you know, this type of thing and solar development in general and said, we really don't want to give up all our agricultural land. We'd like it to be a diversity of, you know, preference for moving on to brownfields rather than agricultural sites. And so that makes sense. Connecticut, Massachusetts, basically, if you bid power into the market, you get a certain adder. So if two people bid 10 cents to sell power, the brownfield will have a preference over an agricultural site. New York State, New York Sun is the program that gives a grant for all solar projects. Basically, a brownfield or a landfill gets more of a grant. And in addition, the New York Seeker exemption is important. Basically, we have an easier permitting path if we're located on a brownfield and landfill. I'll talk more about the brownfield cleanup program in New York at the end, but the sites such as the one we talked about in downtown Buffalo, if you're eligible for a grant under a brownfield cleanup program, you still are, in addition to the programs that we're showing here. And then just two newer programs that are being, you know, implemented soon. Ohio is looking at a proposed community development regulation. This is sort of an important distinction. I think everybody on the call would recognize if you had a 100-acre coal mine or a 100-acre, you know, landfill site, it doesn't make sense for a program to say you should only use 75 of those acres. You know, you should use the whole site. And so size limitations on brownfields and landfills, you know, often don't make sense, and they don't make common sense either, in the sense that you really need to recognize that if you have a larger site, you really want them to use the entire site, and limiting it for the purpose of a program, you know, often shouldn't apply. So in the case of Ohio, you know, where there might be a 5 or a 10 megawatt limit on a project, expanding that for the, if you're located on brownfields and landfills or coal mines, just makes an awful lot of sense. A similar type of thing in Maryland, where there are some larger type of sites. We actually did a relatively, in those days, a very large site, 12 megawatts AC, in Annapolis. And we were able to do it by basically combining six smaller sites, and co-location made a lot of sense in that case. And it's something that in other states does make an awful lot of sense to be able to look at brownfields and landfills and go from there. This is just a quick one of what works and what doesn't work. So programs that influence success is obvious. Cash incentives is always great. Permit facilitation, such as New York, basically allowing, you know, a quicker application. We're not going to do environmental damage, and that's clear from the application, but we're just looking to make sure that that's reviewed in a timely fashion. Interconnection queues are a big deal throughout the country right now. To the extent you're on a brownfield and you could accelerate that process, that would be outstanding. And as I said before, elimination of size restrictions. What doesn't work is to decide that the solar project should clean up a brownfield site that, you know, might be a Superfund project or something else. The economics of a solar project, whether it's on a brownfield or not, are tight. Interest rates have not helped any of us. But I think if you're looking to clean up, add to the complications of developing a solar project by saying you should clean up a legacy solar environmental issue on the site, it's going to be make things very, very difficult in general. I think this is a list that is also available from EPA. The EPA resources, I know that we all make fun of the government. These are excellent. If you're going into a state, reading it and working through it, or if you're in a state that's thinking about developing policy, you know, reading these and making themselves familiar with it is an outstanding idea. Again, I think these links are already up on the chat room or in the website. That's me, and that's how you can reach me, and I can turn it over back to Laura or over to Kyle, as the case may be.
Excellent. Thanks, Paul. I'm going to share my screen. And Jean, does that look good on your end?
It looks great. Go ahead.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Paul, for the handoff. And thank you, Laura and the Repowering Initiative for hosting this wonderful webinar. I echo Paul's statements at the top of his presentation. Solar on formerly contaminated land makes sense. It's a way to repurpose these formerly, dirty, contaminated lands for a beneficial reuse to the property as well as to local community members and to the township and to the government as well. So AC, I'm going to spend my portion of the presentation focusing on the great state of New Jersey and the success that AC Power has had developing solar on these types of properties. AC Power is a mission-driven organization. Our focus is to re-energize communities with solar one brownfield at a time. And so we really look to develop projects that can provide a host of benefits to a holistic project to, in terms of benefits to the community members. And I'm
Kyle, I apologize. Yeah. I think we lost one of your earbud mics. Your audio level just dropped a little bit for us.
Okay.
That's the one we needed. Thank you.
Sorry about that. And so with that, I'll move on to a little bit about the New Jersey program. So New Jersey has been at the forefront of transforming brownfields into solar energy sources. They have existing 400 megawatts of solar on these types of properties already developed. The program was initially started in 2012 for the Subsection T program, which established a program for SRECs to be generated by solar on brownfields, areas of historical fill, as well as the properly closed sanitary landfill. That program was very successful and allowed a lot of solar to move through the development pipeline. In 2018, New Jersey passed the Clean Energy Act, where they required the Board of Public Utilities to implement the Community Solar Energy Program. The Community Solar Energy Program was initially a pilot program, which what Laura mentioned is a really important kind of training ground for being able to understand what are the important attributes for a successful program and understanding really the benefits, like what benefits does the state as well as the development community as well as the people that are going to be impacted by these projects, stakeholders. And so through that pilot program, AC Power found a lot of success to be able to develop projects because community solar enabled us to sell power at closer to the retail rate of electricity. And that's a really important fact about developing solar on brownfields, landfills, is that a lot of these sites are not near significant load. And so that, and without, load to offset, developers need some kind of mechanism to sell that power. And so community solar is a great avenue for allowing developers to site projects not near load, but be able to sell power to folks that can benefit and receive discounts on their utility bills. And so through that program, the BPU also provided siting criteria that basically gave preference to projects that are located on disturbed or already developed areas. So rooftop projects, landfill projects, projects on former resource extraction facilities. And so that allowed projects to be kind of prioritized for our exact focus. So again, I want to echo the real importance of being able to have a pilot program, be able to learn and have a trial period. And now New Jersey has implemented their permanent community solar program and has adjusted some of the lessons learned from that pilot to be able to have a more long-standing program that can be replicated year after year. And so 150 megawatts were going to be allocated. And actually, earlier this year, Governor Murphy passed a bill that I think 225 more megawatts is going to be added to this year. So again, that's a clear sign that the program is working, which is just a real benefit to developers because then we know that the program is going to be there. One of the biggest challenges for AC power is often the boom and bust cycle of incentive programs where a program opens and it quickly closes. It opens and closes. And that's very hard for us to build the kind of sustainable business model. So I encourage anyone looking to have a blueprint of how to potentially, you know, make a program is to be able to provide stability and certainty in the market that allows folks to develop projects over an extended period of time. Again, as Laura mentioned, these projects can take significant time to develop. And New Jersey was an excellent example by, you know, giving projects on landfills more time to complete development as opposed to maybe traditional rooftop projects. The last thing I want to mention about New Jersey is the streamlined permitting process. A little bit similar to New York, but there's a state statute that allows for solar on closed landfills and former resource extraction facilities to be a permitted use. So there is not a need to do zoning variances or zoning changes. And so the ability to go straight to a planning board reduces some of the soft costs of permitting, as well as provides us a kind of a clear-cut roadmap to be able to get a project from origination to development task complete. And so that's a real, I think, a great model to be, or maybe blueprint for other states to look at about how they could potentially reduce some of the soft costs of permitting. Now, I always think it's helpful to look at an example. So I want to share about one of AC Power projects, the Global Sanitary Landfill Project. This is a project that has been developed over the last 4 years at AC Power. It was operational in November of last year. It was a participant in the Year 2 Community Solar Pilot Program. And this project is an excellent example about how to transform a Superfund site into a community solar facility that is going to offer economic benefits to the local township through a payment in lieu of taxes agreement, which allows the township to generate tax revenue for school or other administrative functions and really to support local economic development. The project also has a commitment to offer subscriptions to low and moderate income households, 51% minimum requirement, which is another great lesson from the community solar program in New Jersey, is that was essentially kind of a mandate or a focus that you had to make that commitment to low and moderate income residents. And then lastly, I think it's important to note that this project had to have significant stakeholder engagement from the PRP group, which is the potentially responsible party group who is responsible for the post-closure care of the landfill. And so we had to work closely with that group to ensure a design that was going to be complementary and coexist with the long-term post-closure care of the Superfund landfill site. And so this landfill was closed in the early 2000s, and it was, you know, we had to do geotech analysis with, and non-invasive geotech analysis about slope stability to ensure that we were proposing a project that was going to, you know, withstand the top of the cap for the total project life of 25, 30 years. And so with that, I wanted to conclude my section with a little bit about how maybe the New Jersey program can kind of be scaled to nationwide. I think what New Jersey is able to offer is a full package of the community solar incentives, the streamlined permitting process. And I fully recognize that that might not be possible for every state and might not be in the best interest of every state. That said, I think there are ways to kind of, to cherry pick certain aspects of the program that may be beneficial. That, and I want to encourage the one of the biggest takeaways is that certainty in development is something that we really desire and really seek. And so by providing the kind of plan that New Jersey did through the pilot and then through a permanent program, it allowed us to better understand our position in the state and understand how we can allocate resources. And so I think that's one of the biggest kind of aspects to take on that first point. On the second point, I think I want to make sure that the programs that offer benefits to the local communities that you develop, whether it is through that payment in lieu of taxes or through job creation and workforce development, is a way to make sure that solar is not just being dropped in a community and not necessarily allowing others to benefit from it. So I think making sure that that's included in your program design is important. And last but not least, I think the Inflation Reduction Act has provided a lot of momentum for brownfield solar development. And the great way to pair the state programs with the federal programs is to understand what are their strengths and maybe their shortcomings, and find out how those projects can kind of, where the state programs can fill in the gaps of the federal programs. And so I think that's, there's a lot to that, but I just, it's important that they are complementary of each other and not necessarily programs in a vacuum. And I will leave you with some information about how to get in touch with AC Power and our website. So with that, I'll hand it back to Laura.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Kyle. Those were great examples and really great to see the projects that you're working on and your view of how state programs can be helpful to incentivizing these types of activities. So beyond the state programs that you've highlighted today, in your presentations, are there others that have been helpful to your work on contaminated sites? Paul, do you want to take that?
Sure. We've done projects in a number of states that I didn't mention. You know, we've got a really cool project down in Texas where, you know, it's located in the city of Houston, so it's received you know, a great deal of assistance from the mayor's office in terms of just working through the bureaucracy of doing these types of things. And that's a great value. You know, throughout the country, I think when we've worked on coal mines, as an example, you know, Pennsylvania, I don't think we mentioned very much. When we went to the DEP there, we got a great reception of trying to repurpose a coal mine, you know, with solar energy. So I think there's a large number of them. The other one that we didn't mention, frankly, we're focused on solar, but, you know, throughout a number of states are interested in battery programs as well. In Texas in particular, where, you know, there's all sorts of stories about the ERCOT grid, being able to incorporate batteries, you need to have, you know, certainly the same issues of putting them on brownfields and landfills, but you know, new people who've never really considered, you know, putting batteries you know, on a site like this is just a new thing that whenever it's a new thing, it makes regulators uncomfortable. So I think generally speaking, the good news is that when we went to Texas, they were uncomfortable at first. We told them to call up New York, call up Maryland, call up, you know, Virginia, et cetera, and there's a network now of states that are able to talk technically and not just have to trust people like Kyle and I.
Really great. Kyle, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just add, I spent a lot of my time talking about community solar as an avenue. And community solar is a massive lift. We fully recognize that, and there's some challenges. So I do think it's important to point out that virtual net metering or remote net metering is another avenue for solving the offtake challenge for our project. So I like to point out New York as a great model for allowing virtual net metering within the same utility service territory. That allows, again, the kind of the same problem about having no load on site and being able to sell it to local hospitals, schools, people and organizations that need to have an energy demand. and not necessarily having the kind of full structure of community solar. That's another way to be able to allow these projects to move through development.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. That's really great. So do you have, I see a lot of questions in the chat here. Gonna try to summarize some of them. One is, are there examples of maps that identify preferred sites? And there are examples for maps, and you can get to a lot of those through the EPA's Repowering website. We have a national mapping tool, and then we also have links to particular state tools that we are aware of. There may be more out there, but that's a great question. Thank you so much for that question. And so for states that are, I also see a question about how can New Jersey improve its program, but let's make that a little bit broader. We can ask you, do you have suggestions for states considering adding or even modifying programs that they already have to encourage renewables on contaminated?
You know, I think the community, Kyle hit it on the head, the community solar model. If you go up to the average guy outside your office today and say, you know, would you like to buy power from a local source of electricity? They'll all say yes. People enjoy that model of knowing where their electricity comes from. It has to be economic, of course. But I think, you know, the idea that you can link power usage, which is such an invisible thing, you know, you've got this outlet there that power just comes through magically. But the fact that you can economically link your power to someplace else, you know, Kyle had mentioned universities. You know, we've been selling power to schools, universities, municipalities, hospitals, whatever, for a long time. And they use it as a promotional thing, but they also use it because they have sustainability goals as well. So I think the greater use of community solar, which we're seeing in a number of states being considered and so forth, is an excellent way for more renewables to be, you know, to be pushed in through the market, if you will.
And Kyle, do you want to just take a second and explain to folks what community solar is?
Yeah, happy to. So community solar allows for the power to be exported from a solar PV facility directly to the grid, and the local residences and businesses are able to sign up for a subscription to that solar PV facility for a portion of their energy consumption, and then the consumer receives a discount on that credit that they receive from power generated at the solar facility. So it's not necessarily that you're owning a piece of the solar facility or you have some kind of investment or carry stake. You're really subscribing to the power generated, and there are community solar, you know, companies that will manage your subscription and making sure that you have the proper discounts on your monthly electric bill.
Thank you so much. So this isn't particularly related to state policies, but I saw a lot of questions about a rule of thumb for minimum land area to make the solar project economically viable. Paul and Kyle, is there a minimum?
Yeah, probably. I don't know that there has to be a minimum. If you're going to use the power yourself, let's start there. But generally for a commercial project, 5 acres is probably a good rule of thumb. That'd be a, you know, sort of a megawatt. Generally speaking, we wind up, you know, having to consider wetlands, having to consider slopes, a lot of other things. But, you know, a good 5 megawatt project, 5 acre project, excuse me, near a city. Well, we've got one, you know, 20 minutes north of Manhattan. That's a really great project, and that's fine. And if you're out in the middle of nowhere, 5 acres is probably too small, but it depends on the power lines and lots of other things, but that's a rule of thumb.
Kyle, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, 5 acres is a good rule of thumb. I would say that it's important to distinguish the size of the property versus the size of the developable area, as Paul mentioned. There are design constraints like topography, wetlands, flood zones that can really start to shrink where you're allowed to develop. And There's also zoning setbacks, things of that nature. So I think it's important to think about it in the context of, yeah, like what's the available acreage for development, not necessarily just the whole parcel of land. But we generally have different rules of thumb for different markets, given what incentive programs are available. So in New Jersey, you can make smaller projects work because of the program. In other states, where there may not be as much upfront money for these types of projects, you may need to get larger, acreage to allow for economies of scale on the construction side.
Great, thank you. That's perfect. So we're getting a question about regions of the country and, tailored programs, tailored requirements for encouraging this type of activity. How do the regions of the country, Paul, you said you were working in Texas, for example, how do site sizes vary? And are you getting into more projects that are larger because of different, I saw Ohio, for example, is on your slide. Are you interested in particular sizes per region, and how are those state policies playing in there?
Sure, Ohio is an interesting example because, we went there because coal companies, frankly, we talk a lot to coal companies that have a lot of land that has power lines there, that's an advantage. Now Ohio is coming forth with some community programs that are, different than why we went there, but we think it's great as well. So it depends on the state. By and large, west of the Mississippi, we are probably at the moment only working with utility scale projects. That can change, but I think by and large, you're competing against, very large utility scale projects, as Kyle said. And so economically to be in that type of regime, you need to be over 50 megawatts and probably, maybe even over 100. So the economy of scale is important in the region. The policy, though, as Ohio did, could say, wait a second, even though we have lots of coal mines in Colorado, as an example, or New Mexico or Arizona, we would like to see more of that community solar type of thing. And that would allow us to compete in a different playing field, which would be important to us. There are lots and lots of brownfield. Somebody told me that your list, Laura, has 450,000 sites in it. There's lots of brownfields in each of those states that we could redevelop. But economically, without a state program, we really can't compete against a 500 megawatt solar field.
Kyle, do you want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, I think it's with regions, I think I agree with everything Paul said. I think one of the things that we've experienced when we traverse into a new market to try to understand how to develop solar there is the utilities are very different everywhere we go. Like, I think there's a lot of engagement and buy-in needed from the utilities on the types of projects that we develop. And I think they have to be an important stakeholder when thinking about programs for solar on contaminated land and thinking about how we can potentially find ways to work together, which it's easier said than done for sure. But I think when we've gone to other regions where they're maybe less established on solar, there's a pretty big learning curve that we've had to navigate that can be a hindrance for us, or slow our development down, as opposed to like when we're working in New Jersey, New York, states in the Northeast, where there's already established record of how the interconnection process works. So I wanted to make sure I highlight that.
Okay, thank you. So we have a question about cost sharing, and I think this is relevant because the economics are really what drive these projects. So the question is about, do you have any lessons on utility and utility commission interactions? It's related to, does the developer pay for the utility upgrade? Is the utility justified with a rate-based investment. How do you take into consideration those types of financial decisions, and are there any policies that address those?
Sure. Very little to do with brownfields. We do it every day, but it's not unique to brownfields. Two or three different models. Generally speaking, anything that is built on site, so all of the breakers, meters, et cetera, we pay for. It's common that if we have to build a line exclusively for our service, we pay for that as well. It's also common that if the utility is going to have to build a, you know, an enhanced substation that might benefit other people, that we would have to post a letter of credit for that, and that can be a very large letter of credit, to basically ensure that we're going to be there as part of their rate-basable new equipment. So there's three or four different models there. And as I say, none of them are unique to a brownfield. The good news is that it's not uncommon if we're doing a true brownfield, so a coal mine, a steel mill, that type of thing, that those facilities have been historically used power and often a lot of power, so that the facilities that are on site, you know, we can put reuse and not have to build a lot of offsite lines. It's oftentimes a power project, this will sound weird, but a solar project or a battery project, people accept what you're doing on your own property, but as soon as you have to build a power line through somebody's community, that can get very, very difficult. So the power on the brownfield is great, but building a line off the brownfield can be troublesome.
Kyle, did you have any comments on that utility and utility?
Yes, in terms of, yeah, in terms of where we found success, it's definitely on the distributed generation side and cost sharing on substation upgrades, where we are maybe paying for an upfront investment to improve the substation, but there's a mechanism that allows developers of projects following the first project to be able to benefit from those upgrades. And so I would encourage anyone that's interested to look at the New York Standard Interconnection Requirement document that outlines the cost sharing mechanisms that the state offers as one example, or maybe a blueprint for how to adopt effective cost sharing structures.
Great. And like Paul said, those are not unique to brownfields. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, thank you. So I think this will be our last question. What is one or two actions that a local government could take? If there's a local community or a site owner, what can they do to help with development of renewables on contaminated land?
You know, this will sound the opposite of what you'd expect, but we love telling the community what we're going to do. And getting the word out is actually surprisingly hard. But having a forum where we can, you know, meet in town hall or on Zoom nowadays and so forth, so that people are not surprised, is really of tremendous benefit to us. So, you know, to the extent that we can, you know, have community meetings that are organized by the municipality, facilitated by not us, somebody that, you know, has, you know, no skin in the game or just wants to make sure that it's well heard, is tremendously valuable to us. It's hard to reach people nowadays. You don't just post a flyer on the community bulletin board anymore. And so getting the word out that we're going to talk about a solar project on the old landfill. First off, it often surprises people that there is a landfill in their town. But I think it allows people to voice issues that nips it in the butt, or, you know, lets us know really what are the problems that we might face.
I would just add that definitely leverage the resources that the EPA has to offer and link on these guides. I think we use them as developers in terms of what our expectations are and in terms of navigating like permitting and all of the challenges. And so I think it's a great way to establish that baseline of understanding. And so I'd encourage anyone that attended today's webinar to really spend some time with those materials, because as much as we can educate and inform about the options, I think that increases the likelihood of being able to, you know, carry out our mission, you know, of developing these contaminated land.
Super. Thank you so much to Paul and to Kyle. And I'm going to turn it back over to Jean. We used our full hour. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so very much, Laura. I'm going to go ahead and call up one quick final set of reminders before we let the audience go for the day. I want to echo the thanks to both you and our fabulous speakers and the support staff that were on in the background helping to host today's webinar. So I'll walk through just a few quick reminders about our session. First and foremost, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. If you are looking for information related to hazardous waste sites, we have tons of it. And I send out a free monthly newsletter that highlights online sessions such as today's in our newsletter called Tech Direct. So I encourage you to sign up for that free monthly newsletter if you have not. Just as we highlighted at the start of this session, we do have a unique seminar homepage that exists for the webinar. The URL is shown in red at the top of the slide. I've pasted that URL in the meeting chat as well. It's the same place you went when you registered, the same place we sent you in our reminder emails, the same place you went to check in. Just a gentle reminder, all of the presentation materials and links to the resources that were discussed in today's presentations are already posted on that seminar homepage. Just scroll down to the appropriate sections and you can access those files. There is also a link to the seminar feedback form. And if you'd like to get a participation certificate to document your attendance a day, please be sure to fill out the online feedback form and make sure that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire delivery. I read each and every one of your submissions and it helps us to continue to offer free sessions like this through CLUIN. So again, fill out that feedback form, check the box, and you'll immediately have access to a free certificate that you can download or print out. I will also email the certificate to you, but sometimes those get caught in junk or spam filter. So I encourage you to download it and save it right on that confirmation screen. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location and there were other individuals who joined at your location, please simply give them the link to this seminar homepage. They can fill out the feedback form on their own and get their own certificate, even if they didn't register on their own. And if you're one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, yes, it was recorded, we will send you an email as a registrant automatically in about 1 week when that archive is available. And then again, for those of you who watch the recorded version, if that's what you're looking at right now, you can still go to that seminar homepage or click the buttons that are appearing above my head in the right in the recorded version right now. And those links will take you over to that feedback form. You can share your thoughts on the recorded version and still get a participation certificate based on your replay of the archive version. So again, this seminar homepage will remain open from today forward. You're welcome to bookmark it or share it with others. So we hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. I want to thank the nearly 300 of you that connected for today's live broadcast. And we hope that we'll see you on a future internet seminar. And with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.